Okay, here we are again. Class three. A couple of new people here tonight. And so that's fine because each of the classes are like a standalone topic. So it should make lots of sense. It's a course that is based on Buddhist psychology. And then I throw in some stuff from neuroscience and pop science and then my own opinions. The way to start this one is to think, here we are. That's called becoming your best self. How can we spend time becoming our best selves, like when the whole world is burning? Have you ever had that thought of like there's an imbalance here? And I think actually if we kind of delve into that one, it's because often the reason we start working on ourselves is because something's gone wrong or we feel bad. Whereas actually, it's very rare to work on ourselves when we feel good and we feel coming from a position of strength. And then we get the whole imposter syndrome of like, who am I? Here I am suffering, but there's the whole rest of the world suffering. So actually, if we come from a position of a context of knowing that we can actually become our best self, then we can do it for the world, for ourselves, of course, but also for the world. So it's not just ditch the world and focus on yourself. It's like, why? For everybody. That becomes much more sustainable. It's going to be relevant whether you're Buddhist or not. And we've covered a couple of things already. So the first class, we talked about the different types of happiness, of feeling okay, of enjoyments. The hedonic happiness, which we need. It's not that it's bad. Hedonic happiness, meaning good food, good music, good relationships, all of those things. It's just not enough, is it? So, does anyone remember why it's not enough? What the drawback is? Not that it's bad, not a judgment, but what's it runs out. Too much becomes, it flips over to it's the opposite. Too much cheesecake. But also, focusing on hedonic happiness means that we're really distracted from the deeper things. That's right. That said, it's so easy to be distracted, isn't it? You just blink and years go by. The following week, we looked at the power of good motivation and the eight worldly concerns, how they distract us. So, do you remember? Any of those worldly concerns? Yes, that's right. So striving for success, being afraid of failure. So it's not that success and failure are good or bad, but it's that thinking that success is always good and failure is always bad. That's the problem. Because you get your best information from when you fail, don't you? Do you remember any of the other ones? That's right. Seeking the pleasurable, avoiding discomfort of any sort. And so we don't even know that's a problem until we can stop adjusting our comfort level. While we can wriggle, we think everything's okay. The moment we're not allowed to move, or the moment we can't do something, or the moment we lose control, or don't have any control of a situation, then the agitation starts. And then we also looked at cognitive fusion, meaning being a slave to the belief that our happiness comes from outside. So, for instance, me thinking the happiness is in the cheesecake. And if you took that cheesecake away, I'd be devastated. If I can't have that cheesecake, I can't be happy. So, cognitive fusion. Thinking that our happiness comes from out there, from the thing, from the person. Can't be happy without this person. Can't be happy if I don't have, the relationships that I do. And so it's that clinging that causes the unhappiness. So it's a lot that we've already covered, and we had reflection sheets. Did anyone do them? How are you going with your bright yellow sheets? Page 15 and 16 was last week's one, aligning with your long-term goals. And the one that I wanted to ask you about was a time when you voluntarily underwent hardships for something that really mattered to you. Did you think of anything like that? And so, how did you encourage yourself to do that? There's only one thing that's nice. Oh, there's got to be one thing that's nice about it. Focus on the end result. So that's the big thing, isn't it? Yep. Anybody else? I've heard body corporates are a really challenging thing. The bigger picture. Yep. Yeah. So of course, what would benefit you would benefit others. So if having the focus on the other, and you'd have to be quite skilled with that too, because when it's a personal thing, when people making decisions emotionally, they're inconsistent, erratic, all of those things. Yeah. So that sounds to me, your body corporate is going to be your personal laboratory of the mind. All your exams, your Buddhist exams will happen there, everything, and you'll be able to practice everything there. All of them. Fantastic. Which is good, because then you can leave it. So, you know, you're there and you can. I think I might have said to you my one that I was doing when last year when we went to Ladakh. So Ladakh's really quite high, it's altitude, and I was incredibly unfit. I'd lost all my fitness during the whole COVID era, and I just thought, oh my gosh, I might die. I have to do something. So I started going to the gym, which I'd seen in movies of the gym, but I've never actually been in one. Totally clueless, and I'm not very coordinated, so I really needed help with all of the machines and had to write everything down and notes and how to get it started and everything. And so because Ladakh is high and we're going to monasteries with all sorts of uneven things, the thing I was doing was the stairs. And so I think I started being able to do like 20 steps before I had to stop. That was it. That was my limit. And then each week I'd add on another 50 steps. Or another, 50, sometimes 100 steps. And so I just imagined that I was following my guru up the stairs. And I don't want to die. That was the other thing, the two things. And so it worked. It actually made it really joyful. So I started really enjoying following my guru, running up the stairs. So, yeah, we can kind of see that the thing is to have something bigger than ourselves, isn't it? Yeah. Any other things that stood out from the homework that you want to share or comment on? Yeah, because focusing on the details, it's like cognitive fusion, and we start thinking that's why we're there instead of the why. Yeah, and then it gets very pressure cooked. Yeah. And it's a natural thing to do, to kind of collapse inwards like that when our focus is drawn to the external objects. It naturally gets smaller. Okay, fantastic. So this week we're going to look at what we actually need to train in. So the things that don't necessarily come easily. So the three higher trainings: ethics, concentration, and wisdom. So there are many things in this world that don't come naturally. Trying to set one of these clocks is one of those things. And even if you read the instructions, it doesn't make any sense. How to drive doesn't come naturally either. Like normally people learn how to drive by watching their parents drive, and then you get some instruction. So I grew up without a car, so I had to learn how to drive by somebody. You can't learn how to drive from a book. I've read lots of books on driving. Would you trust me on the road? So there's things that we need to train in. Also, I think things like parenting, for instance, where everyone just expects it to come naturally, it doesn't necessarily come naturally. Why it would come naturally is because you've got good conditions, you've had imprints, you've had examples. To be able to bring forth all of our qualities, become our best self, we need to train in all sorts of things, but to actually bring out all of our qualities to become liberated from samsara and to become a Buddha, there are three things we need to train in, and that's these three: ethics, concentration, and wisdom. So if we train in those, we've got all the skills that we need. We don't have to know how to drive. We don't have to know how to cook. I'm also naturally very bad at cooking. but these three we absolutely do need. And so, of course, they'll make our life better now. We'll be more comfortable in our own skin with ethics. we'll be able to focus on what we're doing and accomplish it with concentration. We'll be in tune with reality, with wisdom, instead of projecting all of our stories onto things all the time. So, of course, day to day, our life will be better now. But the whole purpose for these is that they give us a lot more than just a good life now. It's a really big picture. They give us all the skills that we need to liberate ourselves from that up and down cycle and to be able to perfectly help others. So that's the biggest picture you could possibly have. Everything else then comes along with it. So really, it's like skills for humanity, skills for enlightenment, skills for humanity, being a good person all the way up to becoming an enlightened person. So let's do a short meditation just to focus our mind and adjust our motivation. So settling body and mind. First, let's get our posture right. And so since we're all on chairs, then sitting well back in the chair so that your lower back is supported. Have your feet, if you can, firmly planted on the floor, so you're nice and symmetrical. If it's comfortable, have your right hand in your left with the thumbs lightly touching, hands just resting in your lap. Otherwise, just put your hands wherever you like. Imagine a thread of light running from the base of your spine up through your body, coming out the crown of your head, and feel as if all the weight of your body is being suspended from your crown. And feel your spine naturally align. Pull your chin back as if you're making a double chin. Have your head just slightly tilted forward. Relax the jaw. Relax the eyes. Have your eyes with just slightly open so a sliver of light comes in. Put a slight smile on your lips. Let your attention just rest gently on the breath, the natural rising and falling of the breath. And let each gentle cycle of breathing in and breathing out create some space for settling. And as you make space, distractions, thoughts, and feelings will naturally arise. That's okay. It's just like leaves scattering in the wind. Thoughts and sensations may swirl through your mind, but there's no need to chase them. There's also no need to sweep them away. Just let them naturally come to rest. So, as you're gently focusing on the breath, feel how your thoughts begin to settle like autumn leaves drifting down, resting on the forest floor. Without having to get involved in any trains of thought, resting in a relaxed focus. Simply allowing your mind to settle into its natural clarity. And when you notice the leaves stirring again, the thoughts lifting and scattering your mind, then just Gently note what caused the disturbance. Notice and name. So without getting involved in the contents or the story, without diving into the pile of leaves, just notice the sensation or the thought and name it and let it go. A thought or a memory, a feeling. So recognize its nature, name it, and let it go. Just returning to the breath. Just noticing and naming, returning to the breath and letting everything settle once more. And then into this space of natural rest, we can let the breeze of kindness and curiosity stir our mind. So feeling that we are here with this attitude of kindness for ourselves and everyone around us, of patience and care. And also with a mind open with curiosity. And we can adjust our motivation to make it an altruistic motivation, that all the things that we explore and discover can bring an ultimate benefit to ourselves and all those around us, everyone we interact with, and eventually all the living beings everywhere. And so then with that altruistic good-heartedness and motivation, then you can gently bring your focus back to the room and we can dive into this week's story. So we're looking at the three higher trainings. They're called higher trainings rather than just three things to train in, because it's a lot more than just for having a good life now. It's much more extensive, and it's a lot more than just for ourselves. Of course, there's our own goal of personal liberation, but also enlightenment, the really big ones. So not just trying to make do with our life now, but actually becoming really proactive about it. And if we have all three, what it does, these three trainings, they cut the root of suffering forever. So instead of having to, for instance, with all of our problems, like running after all the leaves, solve this one and another 10 come along. You can think, I'll never do it, I'll never do it. So this is, what if we could cut the root of suffering right there, one fell swoop, and get it done, the very causes of suffering. So what we've got is how cultivating ethics actually creates happiness. And this is like in the picture here, it's like having a strong core. Ethics is like our core strength. Having a, you know, we talk about core strength, isn't it? We need it. And when our back goes, that's really bad news. So what our core strength is, living ethically. What it does is it gives us confidence. It means we're comfortable in our own skin. Concentration in this analogy is to do with the two strong arms. So you can have a really focused concentration, but if you don't have core strength of ethics, what happens is you just obsessively focus on things, and it's not going to bring happiness. It won't bring peace of mind, and you may end up being really nihilistic or a terrorist because you have a really kind of incisive concentration, but it's not guided or supported by anything. So concentration, it seems like an obvious thing. It overcomes distraction. Here we are, distracted with all sorts of things. How do we overcome it? We can't just think, oh, I wish I wasn't so distracted. We actually have to get strength. It's like weight training. We've got to train our concentration. It's a strength that the more we do, the stronger it gets. Only do it through repetition. And then the third one, wisdom, well, that's the axe. So we have a sharp axe that cuts the root of delusion at the root. Now, if we've got a blunt axe, it just bounces off. So that means if our wisdom isn't really honed, we can think about things and it just doesn't make any changes in our life. It's like we get the intellectual thing and it doesn't make a dent. It doesn't change how we feel or how we act. Or if we don't have very good concentration and we've got a really strong axe, it's like Funniest Home Videos, you know, you're a danger to yourself and others because your wisdom might be quite incisive, but you can't direct it. So you can be quite harsh, for instance. Cold, hard truths, they also don't go down very well. So we need all three together. So trying to cover all these three in one class is a really big ask. And I'm like, how are we going to go about it? So I thought we're going to do the hardest one first and just get it over and done with. What do you reckon the hardest one is? Wisdom, that's right. So what we'll do is we'll look at what it is, and then we've got also some how do we get started in it, because it can be quite overwhelming. Because really, the thing about Buddhism that makes it different from other religions and other philosophies is what's called the view, the understanding of reality, which means the wisdom realizing emptiness, the wisdom realizing the nature of reality. That's what distinguishes Buddhism from all other things. So it is huge. And it's definitely something that we have to train in. So where do we start? So here's a quote from His Holiness. We are at the center of all of our troubles. It's therefore best to work at understanding our true nature first. So this is great because it's not that we start understanding life, the universe, and everything. When did time begin? What, and all of these abstract, infinitely interesting questions. They're not going to stop us being miserable. We've got to start right here at home with ourselves. What is my nature? What am I getting right? What am I getting wrong? Otherwise, we can really fall into a trap where we have a lot of understanding about stuff and we just get more and more miserable. And we can even see where we're going wrong with things, but because we haven't been able to apply it in our life, we just feel more and more despondent. So why we need this higher training in wisdom is that love and compassion aren't enough. They're not enough to free us from suffering. They're like a balm, but they don't actually work on what the causes of suffering are. So we need both. We need the love and compassion to encourage us, but we actually need to work on cutting the root. This is almost like an algorithm. This is a good algorithm. All suffering arises from grasping at a false sense of self. So we have this feeling of who we are, and because it's just a feeling, it may or may not be true, and because it's quite unstable, what we do is we grasp it and we hold on to it. And we know we have it because if someone unfairly criticizes us, we can't bear it. Or if someone misunderstands us, we can't bear it. Whereas actually, if you think about it, it doesn't matter what people think of you. It doesn't make any difference at all. But why can't we bear it? Because we're grasping to this sense of self. And it's the grasping that is so painful. Not only that, but we think we have a real me in here somewhere that needs to be defended, that needs to be recognized and appreciated and respected and all of those things. Which in a way is a red flag, isn't it? Because how come we need to have all of that from outside? If it was actually true, would it matter whether anybody recognized it or not? So it kind of gives us an indication there's something really unstable going on here. So what happens? We make all of these assumptions about ourselves and about reality. And because a lot of them are based in mistakes, we have to hold on to them really tightly. And then a huge amount of suffering arises. So how do we wind it back? We recognize all phenomena arise by a collection of many conditions together. And because of this, there is no inherence. So that means that even though we feel we are us as we are, and everybody should recognize and respect me, actually, who we are, it's like how they say it takes a village. It takes a village to raise a person. Who we are is the result of the type of family we were brought up in, the type of culture we're in, the type of food we eat, the type of education, what we watch on Netflix, what language we speak, all of those things together, all these many conditions together determine who we are. Yes, it's refuting the object of negation. Yep. So you've got to get the right object. So if you race through it too much, you might think, oh, there is no self. That's not true either. There's no inherent self. So even though it feels like there's a real me in here, that is a really strong feeling, but it doesn't accord with reality. If we actually investigate reality, what that is ever changing. So the way I think about it is if we really want to grasp onto something, because this habit of grasping, well, who am I really, is so strong, think of yourself as a process, not a thing, not a person or an entity, but you're a process. You're forever changing according to what's going on within your own mind and your own habits. That determines how you interpret the world. That determines how people relate to you. The whole thing is constantly in flux, interdependent, many conditions together. So you change one of those conditions and everything changes. So if you've ever been overseas and got culture shock, that's because the conditions change. And now how you feel about life, the universe, and everything and yourself, it's like the rug is taken out from underneath you just because the conditions change. And it can be life-shattering, this feeling of culture shock can be really confronting. The suffering comes from thinking that there's a real me and then holding on to it. So we come from a whole range of causes and conditions. Our DNA, our diet, our family, and all of these can change. Even with DNA, how it's expressed changes according to your conditions. It's not a done deal. So that's the first one. The second thing that happens is we confuse the dual nature of reality, relative and ultimate. And so what we think is the real me is just the conventional one. the real me that makes, Miffy unique from everything else, that's actually just to do because I was born tall. Well, if I was born short, I'd be totally different. If I was born speaking a different language, I'd have a different way to frame things. So I'd think differently. So all of these things, everything that I think is uniquely me, well, it's just causes and conditions. Who we are, actually an experiencing being, that's a universal phenomena. That's what we all have in common. That's what makes us the same. But we kind of flip it around, we get it back to front. So the practical thing that we take from this is things, people, relationships, problems, nice experiences don't exist in the way they first appear. So they appear one way, but how they exist is totally different. And because we get that mixed up, we suffer. And of course, because we're so dominated by our senses, we think what comes in from our senses is the reality. But even that, if I asked all of you, what's in this room? What you'd write down, it'd all be total. What things you'd notice, it'd all be totally different. And I know this because every now and again, someone will come in and they go, oh, you've put chandeliers up, and they've been here like for 3 years. So this is just to get you going. One way that we can start applying it is, hey kids, don't do cognitive fusion. Forget about drugs, man. Don't do cognitive fusion. So we'll come back to this again and again. This is a Western term that kind of gives us an idea of what's happening, how we believe the appearances, but just a little bit of investigation and we won't have to be sucked in. So fusing the behavior with the person. So here we have, say, a person acting badly, we go, they're a bad person. They look bad, they're yelling or being aggressive, or they're a kid in the supermarket having a tantrum, and we go, oh, bad person. But actually, it's the behavior. So you might think, yep, bad child or a naughty child or whatever. Then my friends who were in early childhood education said, well, actually, if a child's having a tantrum, what that's indicating is a suffering child. They're expressing. And the same thing, someone who's being rude is a suffering person. It appears rude. Someone who appears angry, to them inside, they're hurt. So there's this discrepancy. So, yeah, you can go, so it's not a bad child, it's a child with bad behavior. Or you could go, well, actually, it's not a child with bad behavior, it's a child expressing suffering. And from a Buddhist point of view, you take it even further and you go, well, it's not a child expressing suffering, it's a Buddha nature screaming to be free. So you take it down level by level. But what you first see because of the screaming coming into your ears is just the appearance. So another, the way that I do it, I just pick a politician, any politician, and I go, okay, here's a politician doing things that I don't like. I think bad person. There's no way they can be a good person. But no, they're a person acting badly, but they're a dear person. Okay, so then we've got a couple of things, one called cognitive deficit and the other one cognitive hyperactivity. So cognitive deficit is where in a difficult situation, we think if we don't notice the benefits, then we go, it's bad. So that's the fusion, the cognitive fusion. So if you've got a fear of the dentist, you think going to the dentist is bad because it's terrifying. Or like me for 60 years, thinking going to the gym is bad because it's painful and who'd want to do it? You couldn't pay me. And now suddenly I'm paying. Why? Because I had a cognitive deficit. I just focused on the pain. The other one, cognitive hyperactivity. Well, that's a fancy term for being a drunk. So for many, many years, I self-medicated with vodka or champagne, which is why I put this one in. So you think, oh, yeah, in a pleasant situation, we overvalue the enjoyable good qualities. One champagne's nice, two champagnes are nice because the pleasure is in the champagne. Ergo, more champagne, more pleasure. Now, how many times do you think I had to learn that one? How many hangovers have I had in my life? You'd think you'd have one hangover and that'd be it. And I do know people that had one hangover and went, ah, cause and effect, they got it. Well, it took me 15 years to get it over and over. So that's cognitive fusion. There are other instances which aren't so kind of silly, I suppose. There was one where I was watching a parenting show, and there were these a whole bunch of parents that wanted to be friends with their kids. And so they couldn't discipline their kids because then they weren't buddies anymore. So that's this cognitive hyperactivity where the value is put on the being friends. And so then, or I mean, and so then these kids, you know, they grow up and eventually they'd leave home and they were like cripples. They couldn't do anything. They couldn't wash or cook or clean or organize their life. So all of this is to do with falling for the short term, the worldly, like the worldly concerns, the short term pleasure, and it might bring long term difficulties. So the cognitive deficit, so we get a lot of this with politics. And what I've noticed, Like when you talk about, I don't know, what's the one that's always big, like Israel and Palestine. So people talk about Israelis and Palestinians. And already there's a mistake there. And the mistake is if we just in our mind say Israeli people and Palestinian people, everything changes. So I've also noticed the way His Holiness the Dalai Lama talks. He doesn't talk about the Tibetans and the Chinese. He talks about Tibetan people or Chinese people. He doesn't say when the Chinese invaded. He says when the Chinese army invaded. So he's very clear. And it just heads off everything, all the problems, just by being really clear with our language. So add in the word people and it'll stop the whole kind of vicious cycle of being averse or frustrated or agitated or, you know, ending up with hatred just by saying people. So I really wanted to make a jacket that had the Israeli flag and Palestinian flag and a people on it, but I'm too chicken to wear it just in case I get mugged. But in my mind, it's there. Okay, so how are we going? Is it making sense? It's okay. So solutions with wisdom, how to develop this higher training in wisdom. Think of it as re-education in your mind. And so how to encourage realizations in the mind? Just always remind yourself there's a discrepancy between the appearance and the reality. In everything, there's a discrepancy. And think of it in terms of cognitive fusion and enjoy busting yourself falling for it every time. So cognitive fusion, you don't have to feel guilty about it. We've got to start getting into the habit of noticing that we're doing it. Another point is to work on your own mind first rather than abstract philosophy. And this is how to guard against getting tired or jaded or cynical. And it's what guards against getting impatient with people. Because things can make sense and we kind of run away with it. And it's really exciting to learn more and more and have things make more and more sense. But if we don't pull it back to, well, how does that apply to me? How do I do it? We lose our humility and we start getting really impatient with other people and start thinking they should know better and blah, blah, blah. And we just lose it. The moment we start trying to apply it in our own life, as you know, if you try to do the homework, it's hard. And that's kind of a bit humbling. And then that slows things down. And now we have more natural tolerance for people. So that's a really important one. And I've noticed in Western Dharma centers, this is the one that really trips people up. And that you can be a really fantastic student and you can fall down in a heap of depression and anxiety and be unable to do anything and give the whole thing up. And why it happens is because of getting too intellectual and forgetting to apply it. And so the wisdom of selflessness, no inherent self, to try. So, I mean, most of these books over here are all about that, the wisdom of selflessness. That's mostly what the Buddhist teachings are about. No, not no self, but no inherent self. And it's a really big training. It's like learning physics or something like that. It's a lot to dismantle. Then the other thing, so that's one, that's the perfect conditions to encourage having realizations. Actual changes in your mind. Even if you just have this, what's called like a healthy doubt tending towards the truth, where you go, oh, that looks like this, but it's not. You just have that habit. So then you start going in deeper and finding all the different things that have affected the situation and how it can change. The other thing is to make sure that we follow authentic teachings. So, have you heard this one that we live in a post-truth world? It's pretty much, it's like if you don't like anything, you just call it fake news and then it doesn't have to exist anymore. So it's where reality and the understanding of reality, it's not tethered to reality anymore. It's just unmoored. And our whole world is like this. And I mean, we notice this a lot when people vote on feelings, and they'll justify it by saying, oh, I believe in this or that or whatever, but it's a very emotive thing. So you look at like what happened with Brexit, everyone voted because they were dissatisfied. And so, you sold a story and you vote for it, and then you get the result and you go, what? And now no one wants it anymore. So how did that happen? An entire country go insane. And it's because when we're unhappy and disgruntled, we make our decisions based on our feelings. Good marketing. Well, that's right. Well, good marketing plays into those feelings. So when we're upset, we're illogical, we're inconsistent, we're incompetent, we'll believe anything that makes us feel better, and then cause and effect still work. Then we get the result. We go, no, that's really the essence of samsara. So when we're going to believe what we want to believe, we've got to check our sources. And this is why we had that class on the eight worldly concerns last week, because what we want to believe is what we like. And that's not necessarily tethered to reality. And so it makes us feel better in the short term, but in the long term, it's just disaster. It also means, of course, that when we're upset, it's no good trying to use logic and bludgeon reality into ourselves or others. That's when compassion and care is needed, when you're upset. And then once you're nourished and restored, then you can apply your reasoning and logic. So that means we've got to retrain our thinking and our feeling, and you can retrain your feeling. It's just like with our logic, we can retrain how we feel about things. So that's why I put this little picture of a kid's house down the bottom, because when we get started on all of this, it feels like really clunky, like trying to draw a little kiddie's house. I remember the day when I stopped drawing the chimney coming out sideways like that, and I figured out that you draw it going upwards. Oh man, what a breakthrough was that! So it can feel really clunky and really hard to put it all together in the beginning, but after a while, honestly, just with practice, you're going to be ending up doing amazing architect drawings and blueprints and all sorts of things. It'll be very snazzy. In fact, that's what those mandalas are. They're like the whole architectural blueprints of reality. So that's just with training what we can end up with. And how do we do it? Use your words. As your mummy used to say, use your words. So what that means is reframing it much more in tune with reality. So I'll give you an example of this. My sister, half sister down in Melbourne, she was just thinking of herself as a loser because she's living in a glorified garage, can't afford rent, trying to save up for a house. And everyone else her age, all of her friends are all like stinking rich CEOs, house, cars, holiday homes, all sorts of things. And so what she was doing was creating community programs in places like Vietnam and Laos and things like that, where it was community education. And she'd be there for several years and she'd develop the whole thing so that the community could run it. So she'd build herself out of a job. So then they're self-sustaining and her job ends. Fantastic. All the other people built those communities so that they were the CEO and only they knew how to do anything. So they had to be employed the entire time. And so who's the loser here? But it's hard if you're there and you're living in a glorified garage with the whole pressure of society, you think, I've done something wrong here. And I had to, and it's to do with the framing to say, no, what you've done is amazing. It's just against the grain, but you have to say it. You have to frame it. Stop calling yourself a loser. You're not. You're deeply ethical and have made this incredible impact on all these people's lives, and you've lived according to your values. So it's all in the framing, and the framing really matters. Okay. Then we've got training and higher concentration. So, what is concentration? Concentration, here's the definition: a mental factor, so it's something that does in our mind, capable of abiding one pointedly on an object of virtue without distraction. So it doesn't mean just abiding on anything, because higher concentration means being able to focus on an object of virtue. So that's a technical term. Virtue is what creates happiness in the mind, long-term happiness. So an object of virtue is like being able to abide on the causes of happiness. So wisdom, compassion, love, patience, all of these things that create happiness within our mind. So it's not just, I mean, you might have single-pointed concentration and be a sniper. So that's not higher concentration. You might also be able to play video games for 26 hours in a row without stopping. Is that concentration? That's called attention capture, because it's dependent on the external thing, so you're involved in it. But concentration means that you can put your mind onto whatever topic you want and effortlessly stay there without distraction. So why do we need higher concentration? Because if we don't, things will happen in our life, stuff will happen and change, and we'll forget. What do? We've got all of this Dharma study, shit happens, and we lose everything. We can't, we're just like panic, go blank, don't have access to any of that stuff. So concentration means that we don't lose it, that we can put our mind onto the wisdom that we've learned and use it in the moment. So Mary was telling me before the class that now she can be in a queue at the bank and not get cross. So what do you do? What goes through your mind when that happens? So you're not focusing on the object of annoyance. So you're creating some space in your mind. So it's a bit of a thing of like distracting your mind from the object of annoyance, but it's creating some space. Yeah, so then you can keep working on it, and then you can try looking at the people in the queue and just thinking, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you have everything that you need, may you be free of money worries. Give it a go. You might find that you want to stay in the queue. Yes, so if we don't have concentration, what that means is that we panic. Things happen in our life and we panic. Things change. We might have a disaster and we just, you have that, like you just go blank and you can't figure out what to do. Or we lash out. So that's where we've been distracted from our object of virtue. So there's nothing stopping us. We just lash out. So if we start developing higher concentration, even if we just start developing ordinary concentration, what it results in is mental and physical pliancy, which means it's like a level of fitness in our mind. So I noticed there's a, just physically, there's a walk that people have when they're strong. They walk differently from weak people. So weak people walk carefully and timidly so that you're not bumped, so that you're not taking up any space, so that you're not offending anybody. And so I've noticed as I've gotten stronger, my walk's changed. And so now I take up space. It's a different walk. Then I notice really fit people, they extend themselves into space with courage. And it's like, it's not a bad thing, like a sense of entitlement, but I just noticed, wow, there's this confidence of walking when you're strong. So the same kind of confidence comes with your mind. If you can trust your mind to do what you tell it to, and you know that you can, you have automatic confidence. So we all want to have self-worth and confidence and feel good. This is how we do it, where we can trust ourselves and where we've got the strength to be able to do it. And then we'll have that confident walk. So then we'll be able to decrease the delusions, and we'll be able to increase our virtue, because we'll, our mind will cooperate with us. and we have this natural physical and mental pliancy. So not only is our mind relaxed and open and confident, but also then physically we're more relaxed and confident, because so much of our illness comes just from stress, doesn't it? We're tense. The more we can concentrate, the more we'll realize that it's a naturally blissful state. So concentration isn't like squeezing your mind. It's naturally open and enjoyable. It's like when you're in the flow, when you think of something you love doing. Also, the higher training concentration engenders all your good qualities. It makes all the other qualities like tolerance and patience and love much easier. And therefore, it benefits others. So the big question is, oh my gosh, how do we get started on that? Okay, so in terms of objects of focus, number one, try and create some external conditions of solitude, physical solitude. So that means leaving your phone in the other room. So there's studies have shown that if you have the phone in the room but you just turn it face down, no good, because your mind's still going to go to it. It's got to be in the other room. And also free of distractions like pets, lists of things, because the moment we create some space, what comes in is all the lists of the things that we've got to remember. That's also a distraction. And free of alcohol or drugs. Because what we're trying to do is develop concentration and sense of peace from within our own mind. And just learning how to sit, doing nothing, being aware. And what will happen is sleepiness will come in, and that's because we've fused being quiet and sleepiness. Because the only time we're quiet is just before we go to sleep. It's deadly. Can you imagine being completely quiet and completely alert? So when we have the physical solitude, then mental solitude. So that means releasing all of those what are called objects of rumination, things that go round and round and round and round that we just grasp onto. All those internal conversations. So often we can't shut up our thoughts, and you might notice that when we sit down, it's very, don't even try to shut up the thoughts, redirect your focus. So part of redirecting your focus is, you know, just even a simple one on the breath. Give the mind something to do that is virtuous, that has good effect on us. And Lama Zorob Rinpoche says, actually the real holiday is the mind free from delusion. So we all want to have a holiday. But as we know, even if we have a holiday, it doesn't necessarily make anything better. There's a lot of stress in the holiday, and then we come back and we don't want to come back. So actually, the thing about a holiday is to be able to have some rest and then in these optimum conditions to do some really full-on mental internal work. So when people go on retreat, they think, I've got to go sit in the cave and eat brown rice and be uncomfortable and that'll do it. Or when they go on holiday, I'm just going to laze by the pool and sleep and eat and whatever. So we've got to mix those two together, middle way. And I think an optimal retreat is when you're in a really luxury hotel and you do have a pool and everything's there, you have good food and you sleep and you rest. And then you break out your Dharma books and you go, right, now I'm going to do the deep dive in these perfect conditions. But of course, if we can't release all the stuff going on in our mind, the holiday won't work. So the types of attention, trying to choose an object of meditation, focus your mind on it. Because this is Buddhist meditation and it's about changing our whole mind, our experience, the object has to be an internal one. So not music, not a candle flame, not a thing that you look at. It's an internal object. Even if you do have a flame or a flower or a statue of the Buddha, you can look at it, but then you close your eyes and you have a mental image. So the Buddha statue is great because it reminds us of all these qualities and it's beautiful. So it's inspiring. So you look at it for a bit, but then you close your eyes and you have that as an internal experience. And of course, you're not imagining a statue, you're imagining Buddha. Living, breathing Buddha made of light. So it's an internal experience. Why this is because we're trying to bring all of our focus from that domination by the senses to bring it inwards. And then in your meditation session, you'll notice your mind goes up and down and around and about. And so what we're trying to do is what's called avoid laxity and excitement. So avoid being dull and sleepy and avoid being super overstimulated and distracted. And what drives all of that are all those worldly concerns, things that we like, things that we don't. Or even if you're meditating in a group, you might look around and you're comparing yourself to others and everybody seems to be also together because they're all sitting like this and all of this stuff that's going on in your head. So all of that, the driver is those worldly concerns. So if we have a really good motivation, why am I doing this? To create a peaceful mind, to create a peaceful world, to release all sentient beings from suffering. So you readjust your motivation. Then when drowsiness comes, you go, oh, that's interesting. I'm really sleepy. Oh, well. And you just kind of go like underneath it. And when distraction comes, you go, oh my gosh, I'm really distracted. How interesting. And so you just watch your mind jumping all over there. And after a while, you recognize that the experiencer is quite stable whilst all the jumping's going around. So you're slowly avoiding the laxity and excitement. You're not being lulled or allured. So all of those worldly concerns, they will, the allure of daydreams or the allure of sleep. I mean, this happens to me not just in meditation, but also watching TV. I'll be watching TV and it'll be really late at night, whatever I'm binge watching. And I'm like, oh, I wish I could just watch through my eyelids because they're getting heavier and heavier. And the same thing happens in like in class and the teachings. The allure of just being able to just, oh, So don't succumb to it. It's just an allure. And the same with excitable, being excitable, thinking about this and that and getting super enthused about whole lists of things. Again, it's a distracted, agitated mind. So you just notice and name. Don't have to judge. Don't have to think, oh, it's good or bad. You just notice and name. And then that loosens the grip that it has on you. In trying to achieve and maintain stability, clarity, and intensity, so a good quality meditation session, the key to that is a shorter session. So 20 minutes maximum. And otherwise, if you start going longer and longer, what you get is just kind of subtle sinking. It's not keeping the clarity. So shorter sessions. So what do you reckon is the most important out of those? Which ones do you think, just personally, would be the most important? The phones, yeah, that's right. And actually, if I had have asked this like 5 years ago, it would have been a different response, even 10 years ago. So, and then say before phones, that wasn't, but now phones and social media are so prevalent in everything that it's a really big deal. And I kind of think if I had the same mindfulness about do I have my phone that I had, like, do I have my virtue? So, yeah. So I try and when I go to the gym, I leave my phone at home just to have the practice of not having it with me. It's interesting. Have you tried that? Oh, okay. Right. Yeah. So then, yeah, some kind of meditation session where you just go without it, or like people do over dinner, just go without it, have that experience. Go out without it on. Just getting used to it. And Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are apps now too that help us to not get so sucked into it, but it is a really big time sink, isn't it? So with things like this, actually just physically distancing yourself from them, that's the shortcut. What else? Anyone else had a different one from that one? What do you reckon is the most important? Yes. Yep. Yeah, so there's a vicious cycle with the excitement. I noticed that when I don't have enough stability, I get excited about things, I get really enthused, I get all these projects, and the next I'm overwhelmed and then I'm depressed. It's like doo, 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 bang. And so now I notice that cycle and go, oh yeah, that's interesting. And I write down the things, the ideas, and I'm just like, don't worry too much about the excitement. Don't worry too much about the depression. It's just a feeling. So again, it's like noticing, notice a name. It's just a feeling. Doesn't mean anything. It's just an emotional sensation. Yeah. Anyone else? What things? That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So in can't remember if it's the next class or the one after that. Once you're into the rumination, it's like you can't reverse it. So that's when you've got to distract your mind and change the focus. So you forcefully change the focus. So things like chanting a mantra, it stops that internal dialogue. So once the rumination has got going, yep, there are things that you can do, but we can head it off at the pass so it doesn't even get going by setting a really good motivation. And then those objects of rumination we'll think about differently. It won't be in that vicious circle anymore. We'll be able to actually investigate what's really going on here. Okay, I knew we're going to run out of time. We've got one more to go. High training and ethics, but this one's fairly easy. Right, wrong, and it depends. So, the training in ethics means that we may not have concentration yet. That's a work in progress. We certainly don't have wisdom yet, because that's why we're still stuck here in this vicious cycle. But what we can actually do right now to make the best conditions is work on ethics. That's something we can all do. Super easy. In those terms, big terms. Because what training in ethics means is that we stop making things worse. Like here we are trying to become our best selves. So let's just stop making it difficult for ourselves. That's all we have to do, just stop making things worse. So ethical conduct means refraining from harm. And it's mostly a quality of mind that wants to refrain from harm. How we actually pan out in the end, it'll go up and down, but it's this wish to refrain from harm. So we, what's called, abandon harmful physical and verbal actions. So we watch what we do and what we say. Even if our mind's going absolutely insane inside, no one need know. No one can hear your mind. Even though I have had someone leave a class once and I asked, what happened? And he said, I was thinking, I just had all these terrible thoughts going through my mind. I didn't want to distract anybody. What a sweetie. It must have been so loud. So, at the very least, even while we're trying to deal with our mind later on in private, we can refrain from harming physically or verbally. And what's going to motivate us is and we again, we can adjust our motivation, a determination to become completely free from cyclic existence. So what you might notice is that you've got some default motivations, and we looked at this in the first couple of classes. It might be guilt. Guilt's not a good one for ethics. Oh, I should do this. That won't, it's not sustainable. Bargaining with karma, also not sustainable. If I'm very good, then good things will happen to me. No, it doesn't work like that. It's a much bigger time scale. Or if I'm really good, then people will be nice to me. Well, we all know that's not true either. So forget about the bargaining. That's not a good reason for ethics. Also, ethics through fear is not a good reason. just because of fear of being caught. Because once you find yourself in a situation where you're not going to get caught, there's nothing holding you back. So a lot of people's ethics comes from pressure, from peer group pressure, from fear of the law. And so, then you get books and movies like Lord of the Flies of what happens when that external force is gone. How much are we acting naturally, ethically? Yeah, not through trying to impress others. Really, why we have ethics is because it will free us. It'll free us from suffering. That's the main thing. And so if we live ethically, then actually that becomes a cause of happiness. Then we're comfortable in our own skin. We can live with ourselves. We stop being like it's civil war inside. So there's different levels of ethics. Just on a worldly level, whatever vows you have, if you're married, you've got marriage vows. That's living ethics. If you're in like a social group like Scouts or something like that, that's got ethics. Many people try and become citizens of Australia, and you've got a vow that you say, that's also ethics. You have a commitment to Australia. So all of these things, worldly things, they kind of count. Then if you've got a career or a job that has a professional code of conduct, like teachers and counselors and bus drivers, and pretty much every job has a code of conduct, don't they? So that's something to be really proud of. And abiding by the laws of the land. So even if the laws of the land are stupid, you still have to abide by them, and try and change the ones that are no good. So, like when we finally had the marriage equality law change, that took how many years of work? And so, back in the day, myself and a lot of my friends, I mean, half the time, the only way that you can survive when you're a poor artist is through a life of crime. And so then, you become a Buddhist and it's like, oh no, now I can't do that anymore. Dang, a life of poverty now. So that was just my generation that just missed out on everybody else got richer. We just got poorer, poorer, poorer. So abiding by the laws of the land, because, and that's actually part of, I mean, it can be quite tricky. For instance, like if you're an ordained person, monks and nuns, their vows are to live in poverty and to beg, to not handle money. So that's at odds with living in Australia, where it's illegal to beg and to not have money. So what do? You have to abide by the laws of the land. Just as a way of going about things. But here's the fun thing about ethics. So how to act? What do we do? How to act? So there's the social part and the solitary part, when you're with people and then when you're by yourself. So socially, when in company, watch your speech and physical actions. And a lot of that is just, even if you're just acting, it still works. It still has a positive effect on others. And then you've heard of friends with benefits. Well, this is friends with ethics. Make sure you have friends that have better ethics than you. Because you can't be the person that is the most ethical out of your group. That's really hard. It's very hard to keep your head above water. So that's what's so amazing about coming to a place like Lungri Tumpa Centre, where you have monks and nuns, where you have this incredible thing to aspire to that's right there in front of you. Otherwise, you're out in the world and everyone's like, oh yeah, cheat on your taxes and do this and rip people off, and it's just the normal thing. And you see what's on TV and it's like, cheat on your partner and all of these let's have a fight kind of shows. How are we going to encourage ourselves to actually practice being ethical? It's really hard. So make sure you have friends with ethics. So it rubs off on you, makes it easy. You can tell I come from a bit of a dodgy background, can't you? And I mean, especially when I was drinking, so I just had friends with drinks. And so, you can have a lot of fun friends like that, but it's not necessarily ethical. And there were things that we did with that were unskillful and not kind, and occasionally not legal. So, or downright stupid. And that's just from having just a bunch of friends. And so then when I stopped drinking, of course, then I lost 98% of my friends. And that was a real shock. And then I realized, okay, so friends aren't the people you have fun with. Friends are the ones that help you be a better person and support you being a better person. And so actually, when you talk about a guru's the translation is like a spiritual friend. So it's like the best friend to be with that has that everything rubs off on you so that you effortlessly kind of, step into your best self. So friends with ethics, super important. Then, of course, try and be active in civil society, try and be part of the solution, not part of the problem. Our very existence has an effect. So we've got to use that. Don't squander it. Having an attitude of humility, the way to respect others is just to always think of ourselves as beginners. It's a real safety measure, because while we think we're beginners and we can learn something from everybody else, automatically we're going to respect people. We'll never disrespect them. And really, there's nothing worse than people getting like all pompous and like, oh, you're not important kind of thing. We don't want to become like that. In fact, Geshe Langri Tangpa, who this center is named after, wrote this, the eight verses of thought transformation, eight short verses that every single one's absolutely dynamite. And one of them is about whenever in the company of others, I'll always put myself the lowest of all and treat others as supreme. And it's so confronting, but it's actually, it keeps you honest, it keeps you humble, you'll be incorruptible, and you'll always respect others. So that's on the social side of things. And then on the solitary side of things, so, when in company, watch your speech and your action. When alone, practice good mental hygiene. So that's one of these things that Corey Jackson says, so that's not ruminating, having your mind, keeping your mind clean, focused on things that will bring long-term peace and happiness. Proudly uphold your code of conduct. So whatever it is, be proud of it. And you might find that's quite a radical move these days, to be loud and proud to do with ethics. And many times also with our code of conduct, we may feel that personally, we might feel quite overwhelmed or weak, but if we have a code of conduct, this is why I put this image of the superhero. It's like having a superhero cloak. It gives us energy. Having a code of conduct like the refuge vows or the bodhisattva vows, something to aspire to, it gives you energy. And then Lama Zorro Rinpoche talks a lot about becoming an inner professional. So being professional is a transferable skill to the inner world. So are any of you teachers, or do you, any of you know any teachers? Yep. So if you're a teacher, you've got, it's assumed that you have a practice of equanimity. So that's being an inner professional. If you treat all the students, all the little kiddies, with equal care and concern, regardless of how you feel about them personally. So that's being an inner professional. It's a really big deal. And yet we expect that. We also expect it on about nurses, doctors, to treat everybody, whether they like them or not, whether they're homeless or not, whether they're rich or poor, all of that. It's a real practice of equanimity. And counselors have a thing that I've learned. It's called assumed positive regard. So when you go to a counselor or a therapist, their practice is to have assumed positive regard of you, meaning you walk in, they're not going to go, "Well, here comes a loser." They're going to go, "I am here for you. You're worth it. I'm on your side. I'm going to help you." That's their starting point. Now, usually you only go to a counselor when everything's going wrong and you're a real mess, aren't you? So that's quite a big deal to have this practice. But it's like being an inner professional. We can have an assumed positive regard for all living beings. Here's another one, avoiding spiritual materialism. So not being ethical for status. Don't post it on Instagram. I think there was a whole challenge of being able to do ethical things and not post them online and see how you go, just to keep yourself honest. Also, ethics, the practice of ethics is actually a habit of happiness. So out of these ones, what do you reckon is the most important? Humility. Yeah, right. Yeah, because then we're just naturally harmonious with everyone. Yep. What else? Yeah, as a practice, as an attitude. So that's this thing about, instead of just having the theory, apply it to our life. And part of that, it's this attitude of treating others as supreme, and it's dynamite. If we just go over a little bit, we can do a short meditation. I would actually also think being an inner professional is the thing, because we've got a lot of examples in the external world of professionalism that we can draw it over. And it, instead of trying to just turn into a different type of person, turn into a Buddhist or like an abracadabra kind of move, just think of it as training to be an inner professional. It'll be authentic. Okay, let's just do a short meditation just to bring it together into experience. And then the homework that we've got is quite funny, actually. So anyway, just to settle your posture again, nice straight spine, relaxed body. Take a deep breath and then let the air just naturally be expelled from the lungs. And allow your mind to settle and imagine that you're in a banana plantation and you're strolling through the banana trees and you're going to cut through the false appearances to clear the jungle of samsara. So just like a woodcutter needs core strength to wield their tools effectively, our practice needs a core strength of ethical conduct. So feel the strength of ethics in your core, the embodiment of your ethical principles, feel it radiating through your whole being. Feel it as light and warmth, as a confidence born of ethical living. Recognize this strength arising from your integrity. And then think, when have you ever felt the weakness of compromised ethics or the heaviness of regret? And when has ethical clarity given you strength and confidence to face challenges? And so now imagine yourself preparing to cut down one of these banana trees. So you need strong, steady arms, and this is your concentration. So without concentration, the axe would slip, the cut would be messy or ineffective. So feel your mind becoming like those strong arms, stable and focused. And just like our arms need exercise to grow strong, our concentration develops through consistent practice. And then just reflect, how does a scattered mind undermine your practice? What's lost to distraction? And what becomes possible when your concentration is strong? And so now imagine in your hands a perfectly sharpened axe, the axe of wisdom, not just any wisdom, but the wisdom that understands the very nature of reality. And feeling stable in your core ethics and steady with concentration, with your axe of wisdom, you're ready. The banana tree before you is your false sense of self, appearing solid but ultimately empty. And with one precise cut, you strike at it at the root, and the tree falls, revealing its true nature, layer after layer, and no solid self to be found. So, what falls away when ignorance is cut, when illusions dissolve? So, just as the banana tree, once cut, it cannot grow again. When ignorance is cut with the three higher trainings, suffering cannot take root in the same way. So dedicate the efforts of this meditation and tonight's class to being able to train in these three higher trainings, these three incredible skills. To be able to bring about your own liberation from suffering and then bring everyone else along with you. Then you can gently bring your focus back to the room and so yes, we've seen clearly how the three higher trainings are not just for a good life now, though of course they make a big difference. The homework. Page 21. You've got shopping homework. So the one, I think it's, yes, on wisdom. So when you go shopping, just look at the labels and don't get sucked into it. And notice what you can about the labels and the packaging and where things are on the shelf. And very quickly, you'll find you're thinking about the goods. Try and remember again, look at the labels and the packaging and the circumstances. It's hard, but it's good. This is how shopping can become part of the path to enlightenment. And the other ones are pretty self-explanatory. The concentration one, the notice and name, that's one of the main things. And then just throughout the week, concentrate on trying to develop your own sense of being an inner professional and how that can sustain you. So that's it. It's just one page on the three higher trainings. And really it's the shopping one. And if you want, watch Gruen. Gruen's a fantastic way of showing how appearances are not reality and really unpacking it all, how much we get sucked in. And then so next week, finding hidden wisdom in anxiety and depression. So this kind of goes towards digging into avoiding laxity and excitement and everything that comes from that. Have a wonderful week.